From bureaus worldwide, this is FSM.
Thank you very much, Ollie. Welcome to Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. Where's the summer, eh, Ollie? Where's the summer, Ollie? Freezing cold today. Where's the climate change? Where's the warming that we were promised? Bad times. It is the 11th of June, 2019. I am Richie Allen. Welcome to the programme.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Where's the warm weather?
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, Rabbi Aaron Cohen has been on the program a couple of times in the past. He's controversial in the Northwest, is Rabbi Cohen, because of his opinions on the state of Israel. He's a member of Natura Carta, which is an ultra-Orthodox group of Jews. And he's got some strong opinions about Zionism and about anti-Semitism and about Jewish identity. So I've invited him on the programme today because right across the mainstream media, you're getting a lot of social democratic commentary on Labour and anti-Semitism, and you're hearing from Jews in the Labour Party, but you're not hearing from a large group of Jews who take a different opinion entirely. So Rabbi Aaron Cohen joins the programme later on this hour, and he's the main guest on Tuesday's Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, triggerwarning.tv, my own website, and multiple other platforms around the world. Yeah, it's freezing, freezing. Tis cold now. Said this yesterday. I know, you could have superimposed some of yesterday's programme onto this. I said it yesterday. It isn't summery at all. I don't like it. Pretty dark, pretty dank. Tis dank around. Tis dank. Now, Mark Boyarsky is an old friend of mine and somebody I value very highly. You'll know this. And he's not been on the programme for, well over a year and a half, if not a bit longer. And about a week ago, I invited him back on to come on tomorrow because he's brilliant, Mark. He's a terrific guy. He's great, a great human being, great value. Mark is a healer and he's much loved by listeners to this programme, some of whom have gone and visited him on retreats that he has run and continues to run. And in honour of coming back on the programme and to support this programme, he's currently auctioning. Well, he's not auctioning, but he said to his own followers, he said to them, he's got legions of followers around the world, he said, if you donate to the Richie Allen Show, doesn't matter how small, in the next few days, Richie will make a draw of all donors coming into the programme, and the winner will get a beautiful Maldivite pendant, which is worth around £1,000. So if you donate to this programme, it doesn't matter how much, in the next week, you could be in with a chance of winning this beautiful solid gold Maldivite pendant worth even about £1,000. I'll make the draw and the winner will get it. And that's typical of Mark Boyarsky, top man. And he'll be on the programme tomorrow. And I know that will be welcomed very warmly by listeners to this programme. So Mark joins me tomorrow for an extended conversation. Can't wait for that. Cheers, Mark. So, young children are being recruited by the UK government as spies. You kind of had to read that again to believe it, but it seems to be true. Police and other investigative bodies are putting children in danger, using them as spies. And this is according to a children's charity called Just for Kids Law. They're really annoyed about this. And the Home Office is currently facing a High Court challenge from this charity about the fact they're using children as covert human intelligence sources. The charity says it's putting children at risk of severe physical and emotional harm and that a lack of safeguards is actually breaching human rights law. They've brought a case, Just for Kids Law, have brought a case against Home Secretary Sajid Javid. And it's being heard today. This was raised in the House of Lords last year. And peers in the House of Lords, I imagine they were awake on this particular day last year, were hearing about how one young girl was recruited to spy on a man who had been exploiting her sexually at the time she thought she was in a relationship with him. He'd had been selling her for sex. The intelligence agencies, the authorities, used her to spy on him, and it eventually led to him being murdered and the girl becoming an accessory to murder as part of that operation. And it's claimed that she had been exploited by the police. This is quite remarkable, this. Enver Solomon is a representative of Just for Kids Law, taking the case against Home Secretary Sajid Javid. Remember, they are saying that children are being used by the police and other investigative agencies, and they are being put in harm's way. Enver Solomon speaking on Sky News 2K Burley this afternoon, and he says there's no excuse for this.
We don't think it is acceptable to put children in this position. You have to remember that the children we're talking about here are those who are very vulnerable. They're often at risk of criminal exploitation, or they have been criminally exploited by very serious criminals who are running sophisticated drugs operations across the country. And the police and the Home Office are saying it's okay to expect those children who are very vulnerable and who have been exploited to act as informants, which is really putting them in an extremely dangerous situation where they're likely to be drawn into a very dangerous relationship, further ensnared, further trapped by very serious criminals. And we think it is damaging to them both physically and mentally and putting them at great risk of harm.
There are no circumstances where putting a vulnerable child in that position could potentially prevent further abuse of either that child or others by entrapping the person responsible.
Well, we recognise that the police are facing increasingly difficult challenges and more complex criminal behaviours and criminal activities involving drugs, and drug running is becoming more sophisticated. But we think that there's no reason why the police, under appropriate circumstances with appropriate safeguards in place, couldn't seek to request information from a young person who's involved in that kind of criminal activity. But then it's a totally different thing to expect them to operate covertly or to act as an informant and put them in very dangerous and difficult and challenging situations. We know of a case, for example, of a 17-year-old girl who was being exploited by an older man who was then asked to act as an informant by the police, and that resulted in that young woman being further exploited and even being witness to a murder and having to dispose of the murder victim's clothes. A really distressing, harmful situation that you wouldn't even expect an adult to put themselves in, let alone a young person or a child.
It is pretty mind-boggling that. We'll look into that I will look into that in the coming days and try and get more commentary on it. It's quite amazing. That was Enver Solomon, Just for Kids Law, the charity, taking the Home Secretary to task in the High Court. Now, Oxfam is all over the news today, the charity, and it has been criticised by the Charity Commission for the way in which it dealt with claims of serious sexual misconduct by its staff in Haiti. You might remember this programme covering this issue extensively last year. The Charity Commission said there was a culture of poor behaviour at the charity and issued it with an official warning over its mismanagement. This goes back to the earthquake even in Haiti in 2010, where Oxfam has been accused of covering up claims that staff were sexually exploiting victims of that earthquake. Oxfam has apologised, saying it was shameful. Now, you might remember employees, including former country director Roland van Houwermeeren, used young prostitutes, children, while based in Haiti after the earthquake. This guy had a top job at Oxfam. Country director Roland van Houwermeeren was abusing young children. To make matters worse, Oxfam knew that this guy was a risk because his conduct had been called into question when he worked in Chad along with another man. Amazing. So they knew these guys were potentially predators and they didn't give a shit. That's a fact. Now, this report by the Charity Commission came after an 18-month investigation, and it says Oxfam failed to listen to warnings, including from its own staff. It repeatedly fell below standards expected on safeguarding mind, and it didn't meet promises it had made previously. The findings of the Charity Commission included Oxfam failed to adequately investigate allegations that children as young as 12 or 13 were victims of sexual misconduct against the charity boss. It did not report allegations of child abuse by charity staff in Haiti. It was not as full and frank as it should have been over the Haiti incident. It treated some senior staff more leniently than it did junior staff, and it's just a disgrace. Here's Baroness Stoll. She's the chair of the UK's Charity Commission. Baroness Stoll.
Our investigation into Oxfam has shown that they've had good intentions. They've talked a good talk about keeping people safe from harm, but they haven't followed that up with actions. Their actions haven't matched their good intentions. And we've seen that they've got policies in place, but they haven't applied them properly. So they've allowed a culture to develop of tolerating bad behaviour of their people on the ground. We've also seen that they've lost sight of what they stand for and the people that they exist to serve.
Disaster capitalism is when corporations and governments come running to third world countries hit by disaster. But it's like the fox coming when it hears the chicken screaming. It's not coming to help. It's coming to bleed, to dry, and to take over all the material resources of that country. That's what corporations and governments do. But the charities and the NGOs, the non-governmental organisations, are opportunities for paedophiles. This is a fact. I wonder how many people in the UK really even want to entertain what's going on around the world. I wonder how many people actually pay attention to these news stories. And stop, put the smartphone down and think, what? Oxfam, one of the world's most famous charities, its senior staff are raping children in disaster zones. Not only that, but other bosses are covering it up. It's the tip of the iceberg, right? Tip of the iceberg. 16 minutes past the hour. So the Labour Party had a parliamentary Labour Party meeting last night. It's where all the MPs get together, including the leader and the shadow cabinet, and they get to air their grievances and talk about policy. And according to the Guardian newspaper today, Labour MPs tore into Jeremy Corbyn over his Brexit strategy, demanding that he take a stronger and firmer line on a confirmatory vote. They want Corbyn to endorse a vote, a people's vote, on whatever deal is done with the European Union. Corbyn is reticent to do that. So they met him, and previous colleagues of Corbyn's who hadn't spoken out against him did speak out against him, including Lloyd Russell Moyle and Marie Rimmer. So they got stuck into him about Brexit, but also about sexual harassment and anti-Semitism. Lisa Forbes was welcomed into the party, having won the seat in Peterborough last Thursday. There was no warm welcome for her. Kevin Schofield, the editor of Politics Home, covered the meeting, and he spoke on Sky this afternoon. Kevin Schofield on the anti-Semitism discussions last night. Well, Kev, what happened?
Margaret Hodge, amongst other Labour MPs.
Margaret Hodge. More on her in a minute.
Mentioned that. There was a lot of anger as well yesterday. The new MP for Peterborough, Lisa Forbes, who won the by-election there last week for Labour. It was her first day at school. She came down and was welcomed into the PLP. If you can put it like that, it didn't go terribly well. She was criticised, or the party was criticised for choosing her as a candidate. Obviously, there was a lot of controversy. She had to apologise over previous things that she'd liked on Facebook, which were deemed to be anti-Semitic.
It's brilliant to be apologising for things that you liked on Facebook, eh?
A comment that she'd made about another thread which claimed that ISIS had been created by the CIA and Mossad. So she's got a lot of...
Yeah, she had to apologise for liking a comment that said ISIS was the creation of Western and Israeli intelligence agencies. And it's not as simplistic as that, of course. But ISIS is the brainchild, and these lunatic Wahhabist jihadists are given oxygen, are funded, are armed, and are trained by French, English, American, and Israeli intelligence agencies. This is a fact. God, we can't have members of parliament or prospective members of parliament endorsing such truths. We can't have it. Destroy them. But anyway.
Of making up to do. I'm told that she made a pretty heartfelt apology, said that she would reach out to Jewish community groups and would work to re-establish trust. But she's certainly got a lot of work to do to win over her colleagues first and foremost, and then the wider Jewish community. So that was another stick to beat Jeremy Corbyn with last night. I've covered a lot of these PLP meetings over the last few years, and last night was, I'm told by several of the MPs who were there, was the worst one that they had been to. When after about an hour and a half, when the meeting ended, MPs came pouring out of the room, and some of them looked really, really, really angry.
They were angry. I love the terminology. Anti-Semitism is a stick used to beat Jeremy Corbyn with. You'd have thought it was broken now, that stick, wouldn't you? Because it never ends. Never ends. A couple of brief stories for you. You know, the Conservative leadership extravaganza is going on at the moment. One of the things that's very interesting is the candidates, particularly the Brexiteer candidates like Dominic Raab and Boris Johnson. Johnson, not Johnston. Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab. They're saying that if they become the next leader and, of course, the next Prime Minister, that they will endeavour to get a much better deal with the European Union. However, today, the European Union, in the guise of a man called, what's his name? Margaritis Shimas. Margaritis Shimas came out and said the EU's position hasn't changed. Here's what he said.
Of course, everybody knows what is on the table. What is on the table has been approved by, has been negotiated successfully by the Commission and has been approved by all member states. And the election of a new Prime Minister will, of course, not change the parameters of what is on the table.
Yeah, there you are. The European Union saying, well, we're not changing anything, no matter what. Leave, walk away, leave. WTO terms, stick your fingers up at them and leave. Children's charity Barnardo's has commissioned a report into harm caused to children by social media use. And its findings won't be a surprise to you or me, but might be a surprise to parents of very young children. The charity found that Snapchat, Instagram and Twitter are having a disturbing impact on the mental health of under 18s. Wow. It is affecting the social and emotional development of very young children. Addiction and the substitution of time spent with family for the use of social media were causing problems and mental health issues and emotional well-being issues in very young children. It's incredible. It's affecting their ability to think creatively and interact with others socially and manage their emotions. It's not new to you and me. But it's a stark warning for parents. Now, Sky spoke to children and technology expert Liat Hughes-Joshi. She does not agree that the youngest kids shouldn't use the internet at all, because some experts say that young children should never be online. She doesn't agree with keeping it away from children entirely. This is Liat Hughes-Joshi on Sky.
Some parenting experts and tech experts advocate absolutely no screen time at all. And I don't agree with that. I think that sometimes as a parent, you need 20 minutes or you need half an hour to just do something else so that you can parent better the rest of the time.
So just throw a tablet or a smartphone at them for a half an hour. I said this before, didn't I? It has become the new pacifier for children. So she's saying, right, as a parent, you're harried, you're flustered, there are things to do, you need a few minutes to yourself, well, chuck them a smartphone or a tablet. How about giving them a puzzle to solve? How about giving them a jigsaw? How about giving them something creative that they can build or paint? How about giving them something to paint? Wow. As far as I remember, when I was a child, we loved painting stuff. And you can do it now without even worried, without even worrying about cleaning up the mess afterwards. You know, no, throw a tablet at them, they'll be all right there.
It's just that we need to choose what our children are looking at during that 20 or 30 minutes carefully in the context of the internet. So if you're to put them in front of a really sweet cartoon that's age appropriate, I really don't think that's going to do them much harm, as long as you have boundaries and you limit it to half an hour or an hour at the absolute most, and it's not all day. But it's such a different thing what you're talking about having done with your son to sticking them in front of a tablet or a smartphone, starting them off perhaps looking at something quite innocuous and leaving them to it, where a few swipes, a few accidental clicks, and they might end up in a completely different place to the one you put them in the first place online.
Get them away from smartphones and tablets. Get them painting, drawing, reading, building Airfix models, whatever. Now, strong trigger warning before the next segment, before we end the monologue. There is some very bad language in the next segment, including a word that rhymes with stunt. So I'm warning you, if you're listening to this program and you have children with you, turn me off for about 4 minutes and then turn me back on again. I'm giving you a warning now. Don't blame me. All right, all right. Trigger warning issued. Let's move on. BBC presenters keep falling for the C-word curse. This is true. It started about 3 years ago. I've been following this for about 3 years. It's like a Japanese horror film, right? It's like, what was that film where they watched the video? Do you remember that one? All these mad Japanese horror films. It is a curse and it has spread across the BBC. Ordinary, competent BBC staff walk down a dark, forgotten corridor in the recesses of the Beeb by accident and they get the C-word curse. The latest victim of the C-word curse is Victoria Derbyshire and she fell victim to it yesterday. Oh, have a listen to this.
Steve Bryan, you say that the man that you're backing, Jeremy Hunt. I'm so sorry, Jeremy Hunt. I've never said that before in my life. It's usually men who say that, so I really, really want to apologise. I'm sorry.
She blamed men for it. She said it, and she blamed men for it. It's absolutely lousy. Good girl, blaming men. It's been going on for 3 years and affects presenters when they least expect it and in wonderfully strange ways. Here's a BBC News 24 guy talking about UKIP.
There was a danger, he said in this article in the Times, of the party turning into, quotes, an absolutist monarchy or personality cunt. And cunt.
What?
Personality cult. And you get a real sense of tensions erupting in UKIP, largely because...
Yes, it can strike at any time and leave you incredulous. Why did I say that? How did that happen to me? Here's a BBC weather presenter talking about lots of snow. This is bizarre.
By and large, though, it is simply a lovely winter's day tomorrow. Bucket loads of sunshine for central and eastern areas. Some showers will continue across northern Scotland.
Bucket loads of sunshine. Marvellous. Bucket loads of C-U-N-T. I think he was thinking of Westminster. Here's a BBC Radio 4, which is highbrow radio for the broadcast, highbrow radio for the broadsheet reader. Highbrow radio for the broadsheet reader, BBC Radio 4. The curse got them as well. BBC Radio 4.
The Express says elderly people would not be forced to sell their homes to pay for social care under plans being drawn up by the government. The paper says the Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, is understood to favour a cap on social care.
And we're going to leave the best for last. This is a genuine curse, like The Ring. Like The Ring, I couldn't think of the film. It's a genuine curse, this. You walk down a corridor that doesn't appear on any map of the BBC's Manchester studios. And when there, you are struck by the curse of the C-word. Here's the best one. BBC sports presenter John Inverdale at Ascot, watching the GGs. And you can see how this is a real genuine curse, because there is no earthly explanation for what John Inverdale says.
You know, it's a way of life that most of them wouldn't swallow. A lot of people go off and do other things and come back to it.
Okay, this is looking at it through rose-tinted glasses from the past.
apologise there for a slip of the tongue.
Wow.
But Lizzie, your love of the sport just shines through.
How does rose tinted glasses become rose glasses? I know, if I was on mainstream media, that would be it. Career over, gone. Richie, don't collect your P45, you're gone. If I was governed by Ofcom or bound by their regulations, I would be fined for that. There's no excuse for it, Richie. I just found it funny. The genuine curse, rose spectacles. How do you manage that? Pretty brilliant, pretty awesome. This is your Richie Allen Show. There is nothing like it anywhere in the world. Thank you for choosing it. This is Snow Patrol. When we come back, I'll be joined by the Rabbi Aaron Cohen, live from Salford. Welcome to the programme. Snow Patrol on the Richie Allen Show. The time is exactly 29 minutes to the top of the hour. Now, yesterday we talked about a new book by Baroness Julia Neuberger, or Neuberger, called Anti-Semitism. And we looked at an interview she did with Adam Bolton on Sky News, where she attempted to define anti-Semitism, to define Jewish identity, and to describe what is acceptable when it comes to critiquing or criticising the state of Israel. And it got a lot of attention, did that interview. I want to welcome back to the programme a gentleman who's been on with me a couple of times before. He's controversial in these parts. I think he wouldn't mind me saying that. He's a member of Nature Carta. He's an Orthodox rabbi, and he made the national news some years ago when he was violently assaulted because of statements that he made about the conduct of the State of Israel. I'm delighted to welcome back to the programme Rabbi Aaron Cohen. Rabbi, it's lovely to speak with you again. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I hope you are too.
I'm not doing too bad, sir. I've got to say, when I announced on Twitter today, social media, that you were coming back on, a number of listeners questioned my decision to invite you on, and they said that I should have nothing to do with Holocaust deniers. Now, that's news to me. I don't imagine that you've ever denied the Holocaust. Am I right in saying that?
Absolutely, of course not.
Why would they say that? I think it goes back to a meeting that took place in Tehran about 10 years ago, and the Holocaust was discussed there. Were there Holocaust deniers in attendance at that meeting?
Yes. This was a conference held in Tehran in 2006, and it was called the Holocaust Review Conference, but in the world at large, it was described as the Holocaust Denial Conference, which it wasn't. There were a number of Holocaust deniers there, and I was a main platform speaker there. You can download my speech, and you can see very clearly I was in no way deny the Holocaust. That's absolute nonsense and rubbish. But because I was there at the same time as Holocaust deniers, so I've been labelled by some people as a Holocaust denier. But just to get the record straight, our purpose, I was there with a number of other colleagues, was to go there and say, no way do we deny the Holocaust. How could we? I personally was alive during the time, and we had relatives who were killed in the Holocaust. But we wanted to say that the Holocaust, the question of the Holocaust and the question of Zionist Israeli oppression of the Palestinians are two separate subjects, and the Zionists have tended to appear to give the impression that they justify their activities in Israel because of their suffering under the Holocaust, but which is totally wrong. The Holocaust was a terrible thing, a terrible, terrible thing, indescribable, but that doesn't in no way justify any oppression of the Palestinians.
Let me put this to you before we talk about what constitutes anti-Semitism or Jewish hatred. What about a Jewish man or woman who might say, Rabbi, with respect, free speech is one thing, but appearing in Iran on the same platform as people who deny the Holocaust is bound to offend Jewish folks, including Jewish folks who might have had grandparents or great-grandparents murdered in Germany. Don't they have a point? Shouldn't you maybe have avoided appearing with those who flatly say the Holocaust never happened?
Right. First of all, it wasn't an across-the-board situation that people who went through the Holocaust didn't understand our appearance at Tehran. There were many who did, some who actually suffered in Auschwitz, who complimented us. Our purpose of going there was this: you have in the world many millions of people who support the state of Israel, but you also have millions, billions of people who understand the suffering of the Muslims and the Palestinians. And because they conflate, and that comes back to your next subject, because they conflate Zionism with Judaism, so those people automatically say, well, it's not just the Zionists who oppress the Palestinians, it is the Jewish people as a whole. And our purpose was there, of going there, and it was very successful in many ways, was to try and show that this is a totally wrong concept. Zionism and Judaism are totally different concepts. They should not in any way blame Judaism for the crimes of Zionism.
No, I agree with that. Sorry to interrupt you.
Go on.
My apologies for interrupting. I agree with that, but my question was, I would have enjoyed listening to speakers like yourself, but I would have wondered why you were discussing the oppression of the Palestinians. That's all very well, and I would have enjoyed that, but why allow Holocaust deniers share that platform? Because Holocaust deniers didn't really belong in a discussion about Judaism versus Zionism. So why were they there, and why were you comfortable with their presence? That's my final question on that. Go ahead.
Okay. When one has an objective to achieve, sometimes it involves being in an uncomfortable situation. Our objective was to reach out to billions of Muslims and explain the fact that the Holocaust has nothing to do with the justifies the oppression of the Palestinians. And this was a platform. It was a platform in which we were able to get our message across. It was right. It was. It was a window of opportunity. And the fact that we were standing next to Holocaust or sitting next to Holocaust deniers was something we had to ignore in order to get our message over to the billions of Muslims who were interested in that conference.
Okay.
And in fact, it was in many ways very, very successful.
My final question on that, before we talk about anti-Semitism and the definitions, were you uncomfortable around those people? I mean, on the one hand, they're human beings, but on the other hand, Jewish people find them the most vulgar and reprehensible people because they say that it was all made up, nobody died. Were you in any way uncomfortable in their presence? Did you try and find some humanity in these people? How did you find them?
Well, first of all, that statement that they deny it completely is, I'm not in any way justifying them at all, but it's an exaggeration. They all accept that there was some form of Holocaust, but they play it down. And they're ordinary people with minds that have been knocked off the balance to some degree. I always say the Holocaust deniers, they're not wicked. or they could be wicked, maybe, but what's wrong about them is they're stupid. They're not wicked. They're stupid because how can they deny something? It's like the flat earthers who said that the earth is flat. They're absolutely stupid, not wicked, necessarily wicked. And this was how we found these people. I will add to this that people accuse her of deniers of being anti-Semites. They may well be, but it doesn't mean it's not necessarily so. I would say that if they had said, if these people were going, coming out and saying, yes, of course there was a Holocaust and a jolly good job too, then this, yes, they would be anti-Semites. But when they said it was, the Holocaust wasn't as bad as it was, they're just plain stupid. And that is how one has to deal with them and not be so sensitive about their stupidity.
I got into some hot water at different times of my broadcasting career because I suggested that maybe certain aspects of what happened were exaggerated by the architects of the State of Israel. Now, of course, I understand that great, great numbers of Jews and Gypsies and mentally disabled people were murdered, great numbers. But I've often said, I struggle with the 6 million number. Not that it matters if it was 1 million or 3 million. It's a terrible thing and it doesn't make it any worse. And I wouldn't ever try to minimise it. But I've often wondered about 6 million. And I wondered where certain aspects exaggerated in the early years of the creation of the State of Israel. Am I a anti-Semitic person? I'm not looking for validation now from you, Rabbi. You can say whatever you want. But is that some form of anti-Semitism? My wondering about how it was reported after the war. Am I anti-Semitic?
Not at all. You might not be correct. I'm saying you're not correct, because there certainly were millions and millions who were killed. And, you know, I would recommend you to download my speech, which I made at that time. It's on the Naturi Carter website. Among the speeches, you can look under 2006. You will see my speech. Download it and read it, and you will see what our approach to the whole matter is. Yes, just to answer your question there, yeah, I know people would say you were anti-Semitic. I would in no way consider you anti-Semitic. You had an inquiring mind, and that's all it is. That's all it is. And many of them, of the so-called the Holocaust deniers, have in varying degrees this inquiring mind, and one or two of them I would say probably are anti-Semites without any doubt. But the fact that they're Holocaust denier does not necessarily mean that they're anti-Semitic in any way.
Fair enough. There are many Jewish people in Manchester who might disagree with you and say that me, Richie Allen, the presenter, that I have some subconscious bias towards Jewish people for questioning the numbers. But anyway, fair enough. Rabbi Aaron Cohen is live on the line this hour. Nice to have him back on the programme. When Baroness Neuberger said that as far as she understands it, anti-Semitism is an irrational hatred of Jews, is that a fair definition for the term anti-Semitism?
Yes. I would say it's a bigoted hatred which is thousands of years old, almost as old as the Jewish people. And that is anti-Semitism. But carry on. You're obviously going to ask me some more things. But I per se, that statement I would agree with.
Brilliant. She also said something that was controversial yesterday. She said that Jews are not a race. Now, I remember many years ago when white supremacists in the United States were blaming Jews for everything, for every bad thing in the United States. They categorized the Jews as a unique race, and Jewish leaders in America said we're not a race. It seems to have changed in recent years, particularly around the Labour Party and anti-Semitism. When Baroness Neuberger said we are not a race, was she right, or do you disagree with that?
Well, before I answer that, what are they? What was she saying Jews are if they're not a race?
Well, you won't be surprised to learn that because of the nature of Sky News and the BBC, the presenter didn't tried to tie her down in terms of what I would have done. I would have said, okay, Julia, what are Jewish people then? No, she didn't say that. She talked about Jews in different parts of the world, briefly, cultures, but she didn't really get into it. She just specifically said that we are not a unique race.
Okay. Now, let me just try and give you a few basics, which very few people understand, and that is the concept and the nature of the Jewish identity. Most people nowadays who call themselves Jews, they don't know why they're Jews or where they got their Jewishness from. But our understanding is that there, and our teaching is not just our understanding, is that the Jews are a people. It's hard to know how you describe race, but they are a people. And they are a nation. And you can be a member of the Jewish nation in two ways. You can either be born into those who have been members of the Jewish nation going back thousands of years, or you can adopt membership of the Jewish nation and go through a special procedure, that is conversion to Judaism. But there are two prongs to being a member, to being a Jew, and this is what very few people nowadays understand. You have to be a member of the Jewish nation, either by birth or by conversion, but you also have to adhere to the Jewish religion, the Jewish way of life. What has kept the Jewish identity thousands of years, and it is a fact that the Jews have kept their identity, is that those two prongs. Most people nowadays who call themselves Jewish, they don't know why they're Jewish. They know they're Jewish because perhaps two, three, maximum four generations ago, their forebears were observant Jews. They kept not only, they weren't only members of the Jewish nation, but they were observant of the Jewish religion. And it is a fact that up to the advent of Zionism, people who left the Jewish religion, they may have remembered that they were Jewish for a time and their children, their grandchildren, but then they petered out. People who, for instance, left the Jewish religion 500 years ago, their descendants have completely lost to the Jewish nation and to Judaism. Zionism changed that to a degree because Zionism created another false Jewish identity called Zionism, and it enabled people who have got nothing to do with the Jewish religion to maintain their so-called Jewish identity, but which is not a correct identity, it is Zionism. But Zionism is only 120 years old. Zionism is a secular, irreligious concept, which was adopted, nationalistic concept adopted 120 years ago, but it did enable people who would have been completely lost to the Jewish identity to have something which apparently gave them a Jewish identity. And that's what you have nowadays. You have most people who call themselves Jewish don't know why they're Jewish. They're not observant of the Jewish religion, but they know they're Jewish because of their association with Zionism, and that's their only link with Judaism, but it's a false link. But that is why they accuse people who criticize Zionism of being anti-Semites, because yes, if you criticize Jews, which is something which has been happening for thousands of years, you're an anti-Semite. But and if you criticize the modern version of a Jew, which is a Zionist, you're an anti-Semite. But that's wrong. The modern version of Jews who are Zionists are they won't like me for saying this, but they're not Jews at all. They're Zionists. It's a different identity, a different concept altogether.
And why did this happen, in your opinion, 120 years ago? Why did this secular group, Zionists, why did they come to be? What was the motivation behind that? I know it's deep stuff, this now. Rabbi Aaron Cohen is live on the line. He won't mind me saying he's an octogenarian, a very experienced man, and it's very important to have these discussions, I think. Why did Zionism arise? What was the motivating factor, do you think?
A very strong factor was the was in fact old-fashioned anti-Semitism, which was existent and very strong in Europe, and this carried on right up to the time of the Second World War. But in those days, 100 years ago, 120 years ago, there were the Jews were suffering in Europe, and there was terrible pogroms that took place, and so the Jews were looking for some way of being able to live peacefully. But these were people who were not Orthodox Jews. They had a nationalistic idea. I mean, there were various types of groups, but they had a nationalistic idea. Let's have a place of our own. And they went through various stages. This was started by Theodor Herzl. And they went, even went through stages of it was offered to them at one time that they should have a place of their own in Uganda. This was by the British government, actually, in the early 1900s. But they decided, no, they'll opt for Palestine because that had a cultural connection with and historic connection with the Jewish people. But mainly it was because of the suffering that the Jewish people had in Europe. And I must point out that when Zionism started, it was not approved of by the vast majority of Jewish people, whether Orthodox, religious, or irreligious. And this is a historic fact. When even at the time of the Balfour Declaration, there were many Jewish people who opposed the whole idea. It gained a lot of strength through the Second World War, through the Holocaust. And after the Second World War, there were the refugee situation, and refugees had nowhere to go. They actually did. Again, I'm trying to pack a lot into a few minutes, but there's a lot of history behind there. They were offered, they could have gone to other places, but the Zionists, those who had at that time already built up a strong movement, were determined to see that these refugees came to Palestine in order to enable them to develop their state. At that time, it hadn't come yet, a state. So they only developed strongly as the years went on, and the Zionists were very, very, very successful in their propaganda machine. They still are.
We can come to that.
Your original question: why did it happen? It started off because of a lot of suffering in Europe, and then later on, it was bolstered by the events of the Second World War.
I've had a question from Faisal. Rabbi Aaron Cohen is on the line. Faisal says, are Jews really a nation, as the rabbi said? Ethiopian Jews are treated very differently in Israel and increasingly being forced out. They probably have more Semitic DNA than European Jews. What do you think of that?
I agree. The fact that they're being pushed out by the Zionist people, who many of them many of them have a racist inclination. They don't like the Eastern people. The Ethiopian Jews is a question. It's a puzzling question because, as I said, to be a member of the Jewish nation. They had to be a member of the nation and also to adhere to the Jewish religion. The people who claim, the Ethiopian Jews have lost their connection with the Jewish religion, but they claim some historic connection with the Jewish nation, which may or may not be correct. I don't know. No, but the development of the Ethiopian groups goes back probably hundreds and hundreds of years. Hard to say how reliable it is that they did or did not have a connection with the Jewish people. But the Jewish people as such are not. If somebody is a member of the, wants to become a member of the Jewish nation, whether by birth or by conversion, and is adherent to the Jewish religion, then he is a member of the Jewish nation.
Yeah, it's why I've always personally seen Jews as a culture or a cultural identity. That's always been my personal outlook, but I've always been open to having my mind change, but that's how I've seen things. I want to ask you this. This is where it gets a little bit controversial.
Can I just pull you up just one thing?
A bit controversial. Go ahead.
Not just a culture. That's the thing where people don't understand. It's this double-pronged. They are a member... Jews are a member of a nation and they have a religion. It's a double... It's a double-barreled means of identity.
Yeah.
Culture could be anybody. Anybody, you can have culture. Anybody around the world can have a certain culture and not necessarily become a member of the nation. To be a member of the nation, it's a difficult concept to grasp, but it goes together. Nationhood together with the religion. Then that is what...
Can I ask you on that, Rabbi? Can I ask you on that? Because I think we're straying into the metaphysical when we talk about nation. Because again, we're going back to Abraham, and we're thinking about the promise made to Jews. And a lot of people, a religious people, would say, well, that's a metaphysical concept, this nation, because it comes from the Bible. And some people might say, well, I don't believe the Bible. I think you'll take that as a fair comment. Even if you disagree with me.
It's not correct, because okay. The Bible, although people say they don't believe in the Bible, they don't realise that the Bible has a very, very strong claim for being correct and true, because it's been handed down from thousands of years by millions of people, not just by one. And it's been handed down generation after generation by people of the highest moral caliber who will not try and deceive their children in any way. And that is this is a teaching which has been handed down. To come and say, I don't believe in the Bible, it's like somebody saying, I heard of something to understand that. One of our rabbis said,
but let me say this, Rabbi. This is not sycophancy now. I love listening to you, and I could listen to you forever. And we've got a few more minutes, if you can stay with me for a few more minutes.
Okay.
I could listen... Do stay with me. I could listen to you for hours, and that's not... I love listening to you, but I am an atheist, so I don't believe in God. And that's just me. I deeply respect your passion for... you know, the religion and the Bible and what you've talked about, the learned men and women who've handed down this knowledge for thousands of years. I've got to respect that, but I don't believe it. I want to turn this just slightly in a different direction. I want to talk about Zionism today. It's my belief that Zionism is racism, and I get criticised for saying that. I believe that because of the actions of the state of Israel today. And I want to talk a little bit about Jewish power. This is really interesting now, because I've had a number of Jewish scholars on this programme over the years, regular guests, Shlomo Zand, Finkelstein, and many others, right? And we talk about Jewish power. And I don't think they should use the term Jewish power, even though I respect their right to free speech. And we talk about how successful, you know, in relation to their proportional representation in the population. So if you look at the media, for example, the media and journalism, Jews or Zionists in the UK and in America are very greatly represented in the media, far more than the percentage of the Jewish percentage in the population. And I wonder, and I have had a theory for years, and of course I get accused of prejudice, is that Zionism at work? Is that why we see Jews so prominently represented in the media and in the arts? Because Zionists are very successful in that area? Or is it because Jews culturally are just very much inclined to or drawn to the media and entertainment? What do you think? I know.
A difficult one. The Zionists certainly, they put tremendous efforts into their propaganda machine.
Yes.
the fact that the Jewish people, there are a high percentage of Jewish people in the media, I can't answer that for certain knowledge. I can only theorize on it. I mean, these people who are in the media, they are they're people with high level of capabilities, and they apply their capabilities, and they've succeeded. The fact that they're Jewish, some of them are Jewish, some of them are not. It's just a matter of them being capable people, that's all. And not because they're Jewish, but because they're capable people.
Yeah, I disagree, but that doesn't matter that I disagree. At the BBC editorial team, News, there are great numbers of people who identify, who say they are Jews. It's fascinating, really. There's actually an article written about it recently. And I wonder, and I think those Jewish men and women are, as you said, capable presenters and oblivious to the things we're talking about, for sure. But you just wonder about that propaganda machine and all the rest of it. What about the Labour Party then, in the time we have left? Jeremy Corbyn is a man that many would see as having, over the years, been very critical of Israel, obviously, and was very supportive of the Palestinian cause. You must be fascinated. There's no escape from it. The last 12, 18 months, the allegations that within the Labour Party in the UK, there are many, many, many anti-Semites, and that Jeremy Corbyn is himself one, and Jews are uncomfortable. And I get emails from Jewish people saying, Richie, you make light of it, but we are worried about a perceived rise in hostility against Jews in the UK. And they say Corbyn has got a lot of old lefties that blame the Jews for everything, and he's doing nothing about it. What do you think of that story at the moment, anti-Semitism in Labour?
Well, I don't accept it. It goes back to what I said earlier, this question of Jewish identity. Most people have no real understanding of what is a Jewish identity. Their only connection with Judaism is Zionism, and therefore they perceive criticism of Zionism as being criticism of Judaism, which is not correct. Jeremy Corbyn, as far as I can see, and I have I've actually spoken to him, but not only very briefly, but he criticizes Zionism, which is something completely different to Judaism. You cannot conflate Zionism with Judaism. It's two different things. And all the various instances of hostility are, in my view, are directed against Zionism and Zionists. I have not experienced, and I've been around a little bit, and I've met lots of people, and I meet lots of people, I'm involved in commerce. I cannot say that I find any hostility in any way to the fact that I am Jewish, and I'm obviously Jewish, and I find that I get on very well with all sorts of people. And I found this, whether this is in the Western world, whether this is in the Muslim world, and Muslim world, we get on very well, and no problem whatsoever. The hostility is to Zionists, the nationalistic, and I agree with you, racist concept of Zionism and their activities and their deeds. That is the cause of the hostility in today's present time.
It's brilliant having you on. Thanks so much for giving us your time again this afternoon. I really appreciate that. One of these days, I will get a committed Zionist on the programme, but sadly they refuse to come on the show and speak about these things, and they prefer to say that people like me are hostile towards Jews and racists, which isn't true, but there you are. They prefer to avoid debate on these issues. Rabbi, thanks for doing it. I hope you'll come back in the future, and you don't need to wait for an invitation. When you've got something to say, give us a call and come back on the programme. Lovely speaking with you again.
Thank you very much, Richie. I wish you all the best.
Thank you. Too, sir. Thanks a lot. That was Rabbi Aaron Cohen live on the line from, would you believe, Salford. I know. He could have come into the studio. He could have come into the studio. But I don't want anybody knowing where I live. I'm only joking. We're not quite set up yet for guests. There are other microphones and it's all sounding pretty nice. But at the moment, we're not quite set up for guests to come into the studio. And I do mean that. You know, I don't want to be saying things to you that you've heard 50 or 60 times before. But one of the things I really enjoyed about my days in Spain was having people like David Rubin coming on from Tel Aviv and me thundering away at him about the crimes of the IDF in Palestine and him thundering away at me forever, you know, and then saying, right, that's it, thanks for that, I'll speak to you again, and him coming back. These days they just won't come on. And that is an agenda. It's very simplistic to say they are not scared of coming on. They are not. Don't be fooled by the notion that hardcore Zionists are scared of coming on with people like me. They are not. They're well able to argue for themselves because they are committed, completely committed to the ideology. You know, they're not fake, these people, regardless of how vulgar it is that you and I might think their belief system is. They are not cowards. I think there's an agenda there and they're being discouraged from speaking to people like me because I think they don't want their own people and their own audiences exposed to the gentle, very gentle probing of somebody like me and me expressing my ideas. Now, not me per se, but anybody else like me. That's the story, I think. You know, somebody said to me the other day, they're terrified of you, Richie. They're not. They're not. And I don't wish they were. They're not. Don't be tunnel vision on that. They don't want to. What they want to say to their allies and to their followers and to their fellow Zionists is, the arguments of the likes of me are so illegitimate and so hateful and so awful that we can't even dignify them. That's very clever, that, isn't it? That's what I would do. My old friend Jean Ann always says, we'd be very clever if we were the Illuminati, Richie. You're damn right we would. with what we know now, we'd be very successful indeed. I'm going to play some music when I come back. There is no other guest today because my upload speed is diabolical. I cannot even hold a conversation on Skype or any other communication program online because I've got no upload speed. So it might be a while today, unless I do it another way, before I upload this program to YouTube and to Podomatic. Yes, 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 that's right. So I spoke to the rabbi by phone, as you heard. That's okay. But I've not got another guest. But I do want to talk about Margaret Hodge. Because Margaret Hodge, excuse me, or Margaret Oppenheimer, as she used to be known, is a Zionist. She's a pretty odious woman. And has led this witch finder general madness against the Labour Party and against Jeremy Corbyn. And I just want to remind you, this is not attack journalism. If it was, I would be saying it every other day. But I did a little piece on Margaret Hodge about a year and a half ago, or a year ago. I just want to remind you who Margaret Hodge is, because it's very important in light of everything else that's going on in the world today, particularly around the independent inquiry into child sex abuse. You know what I mean? So I want to talk about that. All right. I'm Richie Allen, by the way. It's 9 minutes past the hour. And this is Europe's most listened to independent radio show, live on Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv, and TuneIn Radio. Brilliant to be with you. So this is Eddie Vedder in Pearl Jam, back with a little bit of chat about Margaret Hodge and more news in 3 minutes. Pearl Jam and the Live on the Richie Allen Show. Listeners have been asking me since I began to make these types of programmes, did you ever screw up, Richie, like Victoria Derbyshire on the radio? Did you ever? You're not going to believe this, because I can come across occasionally as somebody with temporary Tourette's. But no, I never did. It's an amazing thing because in my commercial days, I presented and produced hundreds and hundreds, thousands of programmes probably. And I was not only presenting, but I was also speaking from time to time on other people's programmes. And I did say something, I did say some stupid things on the air, probably still do, but I never swore. The funniest thing that ever happened to me was in the Tower Hotel back in 2002 in Waterford City, I was asked as a Z-list celebrity in a small city, a Z-list celebrity now. And I was delighted to be a Z-list celebrity, believe you me. They said, Richie, will you compare a fashion show? And I said, I will, for the crack. And I didn't realise what fashion shows really were because I never attended one. And so I went along and I met some of the most pretentious arseholes I'd ever had the misfortune to meet in my life. Namely, the designers of clothes and namely the owners of the finest haberdashers. How'd you like that? Haberdashers. I met people who owned high-end clothing stores. And they were pretentious arseholes. Or maybe it was me. Maybe I've always had the chip on my shoulder, maybe. Probably have had. But I didn't like them very much. And I had to get all these notes together. And I had to talk as the models were walking up and down the catwalk. And keep my eyes off the arses of the women models. And the men. Just the women. And I had to speak about the clothes they were wearing. And during that fashion show, I also had to mention various sponsors. And I had to mention a particularly expensive female hair salon. And I had to mention it once or twice. And I had to mention some of the treatments you could get at this hair salon. And I made a faux pas. At one stage I mentioned that you could get a wash, cut and blowjob at this particular salon. And I carried on. I didn't realise what I'd said. And people were falling around laughing and I was getting glared at by the people in the front who had organised the whole fashion show. And later on somebody said to me, Richie, that's an old gag about hairdressers. Did you use that gag? I said, what gag? And they said, you said wash, cut and blow. I said, I didn't. But it turned out I did. They showed me the video later on. That's the only time I ever made a slip up like that. But as for saying the C word on the radio, no. God, no. How do you do that? It must be a word that, I don't know, the Derbyshire had used that particular morning. I don't know. But anyway, there you are. 15 minutes past the hour. We're into the final leg. I want to talk about this anti-Semitism in the Labour Party nonsense. Because there is no endemic anti-Semitism in the UK. Yeah. You said that, Richie, 1,000 times. I did. And one of the chief witchfinder generals is a woman called Margaret Hodge. Nay, Margaret Oppenheimer, look her up. I find her odious. Is it just because I'm completely and fundamentally opposed to who she is and what she stands for? Probably, but it's the conduct of the woman. This is the woman, Margaret Hodge, that in Westminster called Jeremy Corbyn, I'm going to swear again, a fucking anti-Semite and a racist. Shocked even Corbyn's enemies on the back benches. Was told to apologise to Corbyn and didn't. Should have been disciplined. Anybody else would have been disciplined. It isn't the way to conduct yourself within any organisation, let alone it isn't the way to conduct yourself when you are speaking to an opponent, even if it's an opponent across the aisle. But she basically said, to hell with that. Now, I'm not vindictive, so I want to remind you who this woman is that is spending all of her time saying that Corbyn is a racist and an anti-Semite. Margaret Hodge has been in politics for a long time. Most people will know of her as an MP, but she's been in politics for a long time. And at one time, she was the leader of Islington Council. In fact, she was a councillor on the council in the 1970s. So she's been on the council since the 70s, but led the council for 10 years. And that was between 82 and 92. Okay? And what emerged about 10 or 15 years, in fact about 15 years ago, was that while she led Islington Council, Margaret Hodge was made aware of, and in fact we believed that she was aware of it when she was a lowly councillor. That horrific child sex abuse was going on in the care homes in the area. Care homes that she was responsible for. She was made aware of it and she did nothing about it. Nothing. Nothing about it. You get to choose as a free-thinking person. You don't get to be dictated to by me, but you get to choose whether she was incompetent or whether she was completely and outrageously incompetent, or if it's darker than that. She knew about it, though. She knew about it. Okay, so it wasn't a mistake. And back in the day, the London Evening Standard went for Margaret Hodge. Oh, they went for her. The guy was Stuart Stephen at the time, the editor at the time, and he wrote articles about Hodge and how this happened on her watch and how she knew about it and ignored it. Hodge went doolally. That's a great northeast. That's a great Newcastle. That's a great County Durham phrase, doolally. Hodge went do-effing-lally and said that the London Evening Standard at the time was basically sensationalist and it was gutter journalism. But they uncovered that Liz Davies, a social worker in the area, was exposing the abuse in the homes and was telling the council and Hodge. Hodge was so disgusting that she even wrote to the BBC afterwards. After it was all investigated and victims had come forward, Hodge wrote to the BBC, Margaret Hodge now, and libelled the victims, calling them seriously disturbed. This is a vile, disgusting, despicable, filthy woman. This woman who is leading the calls for Jeremy Corbyn to disappear. This woman who is screaming like a fishwife that anti-Semitism is around every corner and is in every house in the country. Okay, she's not quite saying that. Okay. She ended up having to pay £30,000 in damages to a person called Demetrius Panton and apologised to him for ignoring what was going on to him and other victims of child abuse in care homes on her watch. I am not trying to be sensationalist. I am not trying to be a tough guy when I say she is a rotten, fucking disgusting human being who got away with it. She got away with it. Why? Because of money? Because of her family? Because of her connections? She knew the children were being raped in care homes in her area and did nothing about it. Nothing. Nothing about it. Think about that. In this time of the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse. And this is the character portraying herself as a woman of high moral fibre, taking on the Labour Party, whom I have no time for, as you know, nor any of them, nor have I any time for Corbyn, for bowing down to this. Right? I've no time for Corbyn, for bowing down to this, for collapsing in the face of it, as Gilad Atzmon has said, completely and utterly in bondage to this, not going after people like Margaret Hodge, the Right Honourable Margaret Hodge. Right Honourable. I did this about 12 months ago. I'd like to do it every week to remind people who this woman is. And I know the Independent newspaper and The Guardian have occasionally, not so much now, but back then, have written about Hodge and this dark chapter in her history and in the history of Islington. Dreadful stuff indeed. I've ordered some bits of equipment, so if it arrives this evening, it might do. We might have a much clearer audio sound, a clearer sound on the newspaper review tomorrow. I'm enjoying that newspaper review. It's a nice thing to do. There's a tiny bit of work in it, just a tiny bit, but I read the newspapers anyway. So every Monday to Friday at 9:30 in the morning, that's UK time, if you do want to go to my YouTube channel and watch me stumble my way through the newspapers on YouTube, you can do that. I'll be happy to chat with you. And we get a lot, so far anyway, we seem to be getting a lot of comments coming in while people are listening to it or watching it. And I like reading those out, good, bad, or indifferent as well. So that's every Monday to Friday at 9:30 a.m. All right? All right. And tomorrow, I'll have an engineer here, and hopefully this upload speed issue will be sorted. Now, I was able to stream without any issues today, this evening, this afternoon, on this afternoon's programme. For those who don't understand this and the jargon, your download speed, which is where you download music and television and watch live television, is brilliant, but it's irrelevant to me only when I'm interviewing somebody online. Upload speed is the most important thing for me, because I am uploading the programme, uploading to the internet. Most people don't concern themselves with their upload speeds. Most people don't care. They don't even know what their upload speeds are. Mine need to be around 10 meg per second, 10 Mbps, megabits per second, for me to function normally during the programme. It hasn't been that. It's been less than a meg since we moved, and I've been kicking off with my provider. Somebody's coming around tomorrow, and let's hope it's sorted. If it isn't sorted, they have agreed to release me from the contract immediately, and I will go with another very well-known provider, which gives you speeds that are far greater. But anyway, look, all of that is irrelevant to you, but that's why I haven't had so many guests on the programme this particular week, yesterday or today. Thanks for all the tweets today. Really appreciate that. Not much else today, really. As I said, it's all Conservative Party leadership contest. And there is a bit of news on Labour, by the way. I think this might have come in just as I was starting the programme. The Labour Party has tabled a cross-party motion to stop any future Prime Minister pushing through a no-deal Brexit against the wishes of MPs. So again, this is how Brexit is chipped away at, and has been chipped away at for months, even years now. Labour is saying, we will table a cross-party motion to get a vote that, if passed, would prevent somebody like Boris Johnson or Dominic Raab leaving with no deal on October 31st. And these plans, which they want to be voted on tomorrow, would give members of Parliament control of the Brexit timetable from June 25th. So this is a bit of a movement there, and this happened just as I was coming on air, right? So there you are. So Labour wants a cross-party motion tabled, they want a debate, and they want a vote on Wednesday. They want to declare, or MPs to declare, that whoever wins the Conservative Party leadership contest, and will then become Prime Minister, of course, that person cannot go for a no-deal Brexit against the wishes of MPs. All right? All right, I suppose you're not surprised by that one little bit. Bit of trans news on the BBC. There's been a bit of a fallout around a trans person called Munro Bergdorf. Bit of an idiot. Has appeared on GMB, Good Morning Britain, a few times. Apparently Childline and the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children have distanced themselves from this trans person, Munro Bergdorf, which I think was news yesterday. But it's still on the agenda, and there's a lot of talk about that as well. Do check out triggerwarning.tv, by the way, for lots of commentary on geopolitical events by Graham Booth and Hayden Hewitt, and more often than not with a different point of view, a different take than mine. I'm not saying that Graham and Hayden have a similar point of view, they don't, but they take a different perspective on current events and historical events than I do, so check it out if you want to hear something a bit different. Going to leave you with some Madonna today, don't ask me why. I'll be back with you again at 9:30 a.m. tomorrow for Wednesday's newspaper review. That, now hang on, that in mind, that depends on when the engineer arrives here to have a go at the broadband and the upload speed. So we'll see. Play it by ear tomorrow. If it's after 9:30, I'll do the paper review. If it's around that time, we'll do it a little bit later on in the morning. Alrighty. Alrighty. Thanks for listening today. Big thanks to Aaron Cohen, the rabbi extraordinaire in Salford. I must pop around and say hello to him. I've never met him. He was good value today again. That was Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. So until tomorrow, look after yourselves and one another. It's bye from me. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. Bye now.